I'm Natalie Elliott and I'm going to be taking you on a weekly journey into the world of beauty. To many, beauty may seem like a vanity project, but actually the way in which we present ourselves to our loved ones and the world around us has a massive impact upon our self-esteem as well as our sense of well-being. Furthermore, the beauty industry in the UK represents a significant and important sector in terms of employment and innovation. I'd like to use this hour to deep dive into all aspects of beauty, from product ingredients and their impacts upon our bodies to new and emerging beauty and self-care trends. We're going to be hearing from industry experts, government, regulators, influencers, celebrities, and brand founders who'll be sharing their knowledge and opinion on beauty and how it affects you. And gents, don't turn off, as the topics being discussed here on the Natural Beauty Show are relevant to you also. If you use a shaving foam, deodorant, even a toothpaste, which I sincerely hope you do, then you are not immune to the health and social impact that decisions made within the beauty industry have on you. Now, throughout the show, I'm going to be encouraging you to get involved, and you can do this via our Twitter page, at Natalie Elliott Life, where you can tweet and share your thoughts on the topics being discussed, so get tweeting. As this is the principal show, I wanted to start by talking to a group of significant figures from within the industry, and coming up, we're going to be hearing from Carolyn Harris MP and co-chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Beauty, Aesthetics and Wellbeing, as well as Helena Gresk, the Chief Operating Officer of the British Beauty Council, and finally a senior news reporter from Cosmetics Business and Pure Beauty magazines, all who can offer key insights into the current issues being faced by the beauty industry and how this affects us as consumers. With so many imminent environmental and health issues being faced globally, the beauty industry is not immune to the demand for significant change to the way in which our products and services are being developed, produced, delivered and used. It's been a tough year for us all, hasn't it? So let's focus on our well-being and dive right in. Brought to you on UK Health Radio, The Natural Beauty Show, an in-depth look at the beauty issues that affect you. So I'm joined now by Carolyn Harris MP and co-chair of the All-Party Parliament Group on Beauty, Aesthetics and Wellbeing. Bit of a mouthful. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show, Carolyn. Thank you very much for giving us the time today.
My pleasure, Natalie.
Thank you. And I just wanted to start it really by talking a bit about the APPG for beauty, because it's not really widely talked about within the media. And I just wanted to give our listeners a bit of a background on what it is you guys talk about in Parliament.
Okay, well, the reason why we started it was because I've done a lot of work with booty banks, with Sally Hughes and Joe Jones, and I was really impressed by the amount of charity work that goes on within the sector. I mean, booty banks were delivering hygiene products to communities, and I myself distribute their donations around the community. And then talking about them, I got to realise what an economic contribution the industry makes to the country. And then we looked at, what kinds of employment opportunities they were, and that, you know, it was the kind of opportunities where women could return to work and run a family, and, you know, they could get a decent qualification and they could make a decent living out of it. So that's how we started this. So we set about starting up the APPG, and very, very soon after we were in the planning stage, we became to realise that there's a dark side as well, in that there is a lot of things that go on within the aesthetics world which are not necessarily as we'd want them to be, especially around procedures and who delivers procedures and the training and the regulation and all this. And it was something which is an industry that's grown exponentially. Legislation, like in so many cases of other things, was not expecting this boom. Social media has made a massive impact on the people who want to access the services. So we started looking at that. And then wham, bam, we got caught up with COVID.
Yep.
And then we got really cross, because when the government were making announcements on what they were going to be doing for different sectors, and they were offering, you know, eat out and help out, and they were offering 5% VAT, and it was absolutely nothing for the beauty sector. They were opening up pubs, but they weren't opening up beauty salons. And so we started making the case in the House of Commons chamber that this was an industry that was already prepared for COVID because of the PP they were using before we had COVID.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, the services that they were offering were in very many cases helpful to mental health issues. You know, I personally myself have used massage as a way of coping with everyday stress, and it's helped my mental health for many years. And there are some people who have treatments, not necessarily aesthetic treatments, but certain treatments for the feel-good factor, and that matters to them. Especially with women having their hair done, and you can lose confidence in yourself and hence in your ability if you don't have this procedure or this treat, as we call it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with that, because, I mean, you know, actually one thing I'm trying to make really clear to our listeners is that actually this, just because the show is called The Natural Beauty Show, you know, the word beauty tends to be really off-putting for men, but what you've just said there, you know, beauty is so encompassing, actually, and, you know, we all use... Exactly. It's completely holistic, and it allows us to really up our confidence and our self-esteem and really keep control on stress levels as well.
Yeah,
so I'm really glad you brought that up.
And I think for us, when a question was asked in the House of Commons, and that caused titters of laughter, and you know, I felt was to be quite a flippant comment from the Prime Minister around making sort of devaluing the industry and referring to them as salons and parlours, and it just felt wrong. It just, oh God, it felt so wrong. Yeah. So it just made us more determined to make sure that we were keeping that issue in everybody's mind. So every opportunity we had to discuss how many women were in work, how much money went to the Treasury, what kinds of jobs they were, you know, the damage it was causing, because it was creating unemployment for a lot of people, and they were then going to put them onto benefit. You put them onto benefit, it's going to cause the government to have to pay out more. So we ended up getting a bit bogged down into that. So we still had this inquiry ongoing, and we met so many people who'd had botched procedures, people who'd felt that they were qualified to train other people because they thought they were good at what they did. And literally, the qualification they were offering was not worth the paper it was written on. Yeah. But they were earning a huge amount of money from doing it. Some equipment that you could buy and get an in-house training qualification were unbelievable. Yeah, some of the things
crazy
that are on offer, and the only training you need to do is from the company who've manufactured the machine. Like vaginal tightening machine. Why on earth would you have a vaginal tightening machine and only have training from the person who built the machine? You
know, there's so much more to that. The female anatomy, and you know, the list is endless.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. So we just started looking at all this, but there's also an argument, which was that people in the medical sector felt that they should be the only ones who were administrating certain things like Botox and fillers. And then there were people in the beauty sector who were trained to such a high level with good qualifications, good experience, and they felt that they too were qualified. So what we tried to do was not come down on anyone's side, but be fair in what we investigated and what we concluded. And what we actually concluded were that there's bad practice on both sides. Yeah. Nobody came out of this whiter than white. You know, I've met doctors who were remote prescribing Botox for 50 quid a lifetime. Okay. That prescription was going to a practitioner who was making decisions and who would get it. And I've met therapists who set up a shop, you know, in the back of the house, and had no idea what they were doing, but were actually doing procedures. So We wanted it to be a level playing field in terms of training, experience, regulation, and scrutiny. Scrutiny being really important, because it's no good having this in place if nobody's going to actually check it's been done appropriately. So we came up with some, or I think, a fair recommendations based on what we think will be the best possible service that anyone who wants to have this can have. Bearing in mind that I do worry what influence social media has on people's need or desire to have treatments. And I think there's a psychological element that we should look at, that some people look on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook and they see an image and they say they see the perfection there and ignore the fact that a lot of that is filters.
Exactly. And it's just unachievable, actually.
Yeah.
And yeah, to get that look, it's just not going to happen. It's not humanly possible to achieve.
No, it isn't. And, you know, I mean, to seek perfection in itself worries me, because why are you seeking perfection? So there's a psychological element there that we need to look at. So we came up with a raft of recommendations, which I'm confident the government will take seriously. And hopefully we will see legislation coming forward, which will help protect consumers and help protect practitioners as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
From being in the position where they're involved in an industry or a section of an industry, which is going to get an increasingly bad name by the time it's procedures are botched.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So what are apart from just the aesthetic side of things, I mean, obviously this is a huge area in itself. In actual fact, in a couple of weeks' time, we're going to be speaking to a lady who actually has launched a lip care brand that avoids aesthetics, because of course so many women and men actually these days are turning to lip procedures again,
yeah,
for possibly that Instagram look that they're trying to achieve, and you know, so many botched procedures have come forward, and so we're going to be talking more about that kind of aesthetic side of things. But what other issues do beauty companies come to you with any issues that they need raising, or do consumers come to you?
Both come to it. I mean, obviously during COVID, we were hearing from manufacturers of beauty products to say how difficult it was for them with lockdown. They weren't able to produce. The whole issue around the 5%, where, you know, people were saying, oh, well, I don't earn enough money to pay VAT anyway. But it wasn't about that. It was about what you buy. If you buy a product, if that was cheaper, then your costs would be cheaper and you wouldn't feel that, you know, the knock-on effect of that. But we've had a lot of support from within the industry, from all aspects of the industry, from people who are delivering, from people who are training, from people who are producing product. You know, there's a supply chain here. So when you have your hair shampooed, that shampoo's come from somewhere. So someone have packaged it, someone have made it, someone have designed it. So we're talking about massive, massive supply chains, which, you know, and people's jobs. So not only is it an industry which is important to our well-being, it's important to the economy and to employment. So yeah, we've worked right across. We, you know, we've done work with Estée Lauder, Neil's Yard, you name L'Oreal, you name it, yeah, you name a company, and we've had communication with them. And I'm really pleased that we've been able to get along. We've rubbed along. You know, there haven't always been times we've agreed, but that's the nature of making change, isn't it? Yeah. Is to get people's ideas and perceptions and make sure that we move on. And you know, there are other sides of the industry which we will look at in the near future. One thing for me has always been modern slavery. You know, I do worry about when I pass maybe a nail, they call them nail bars, but a nail bar where there is no opportunity to play by anything other than cash. Mm-hmm. You have foreign nationals actually operating. You can tell by the smell that the stuff that they're using is toxic. Everybody's masked up, even when we didn't have COVID, you know. And I do worry about, you know, the providence of those people working in there. Why are they there, you know? And I've heard some terrible stories about how they front for other organized crime. So there's that side of it, but then there's a nice side of it where the industry has been exceptionally generous in its donations to, especially around hygiene poverty, because, you know, in today's day and age, we see so many people actually dependent on food banks. If they're not able to buy food, the chances of them being able to buy personal hygiene products
absolutely
are rare. And then that means that they're not comfortable, or they're not able to go for job interviews. When they present, they don't present. You know, and it's like we said, Natalie, it's about if you feel okay, then you present okay, then life's a little bit better. So it's an industry I'm in awe of.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. Actually, you started to touch on an issue that I did once raise with you. So next week we're going to be hearing from Dr. Emma Meredith from the CTPA, the Cosmetics
Laundries
Perfumery Association. You're both Welsh, I believe.
So yeah.
You've got quite a lot in common.
Yeah.
We want to be talking to her about regulation, and is it as up to date as it should be. I mean, you just mentioned there the nail bars and the smell. Mm. You know, you can just tell from the smells. You know, the human brain's quite smart. It's very switched on. It'll alert us to things that we shouldn't be exposed to.
Well, it's like most things. I think modern society moves at such a pace that things change so rapidly and legislation doesn't. Mm. Legislation gets bogged down in bureaucracy. And unless you actually highlight where things are going wrong, then things don't change. So it's only when somebody looks at an issue and looks at the problems and looks at what's going wrong and then suggests what we need to remedy that. But that takes a lot of work. So we had a very, very successful meeting with the minister a couple of weeks before the report came out. And they were really anxious in the Department of Health to see the report, because basically we've done the legwork, we've done the inquiry, we've looked at things, we've investigated, we've produced a really comprehensive, excellent document that the department can literally just pick up and enforce. So I'm hopeful that we will see a change. And of course, we had the change this year around aesthetics with Laura Trott's bill, where nobody under 18 can actually have injectables. I mean, that in my previous life, I worked for an MP and I actually worked on the sunbed bill, where, you know, we were saying that people under 18 should not be allowed to use coin-operated sunbeds. So I just felt this was a natural progression. I still don't think sunbeds are the way to go, you know, but that's, no, that's an argument for another day. I've done my bit on that and I need to move on now. But I agree. It's not that legislation deliberately tries to avoid doing the right thing. It needs something to highlight. And what we've done is that since we started talking about it, people come out to the woodwork with their problems, with their issues. And you suddenly realise, my God, it's a lot worse than I thought it was. Yeah. But it needs us to talk about it for people to be brave enough to come forward and say, well, look, I didn't want... I mean, people are embarrassed. People are embarrassed that they may have had an operation or an injectable has gone wrong and it's left them defigured. Sometimes they've taken to, you know, I was reading last night that Linda Evangelista, one of the top models, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, she had a procedure that went wrong and she'd been inside her house for 5 years.
Yeah, too embarrassed.
She's become reclusive. So actually, that's happened to a lot of people.
The knock-on effect there can be so negative. I mean, I suppose, you know, one of the things that we wanted to really talk to her about as well, which I know you can touch on, is this idea of clean beauty and what that is. Now, we've got it's 4 weeks until the UK Climate Change Conference. And I've been noticing actually on Twitter, I know you're very active on Twitter yourself, but I've been noticing a lot of other industries within the UK, so sport, transport, food, all tweeting on what they are keen to do in order to contribute to this, you know, global initiative for reducing our impact upon the climate. But, you know, what can beauty do?
Well, I think that's a really important point, that everything that they actually do produce. I mean, there was a big thing with mica beads not that long ago, you know, and, you know, were they sustainable and what kind of mining was that? And who was mining the mica beads? I mean, that was a massive issue because obviously that was a result of enslavement. The trouble is when you put natural stuff in and you it becomes more expensive, that's the downside of it. But why would you want to put something synthetic on your face? And, you know, I think at the end of the day, quality will without, isn't it? And brands which are using more environmentally friendly products will eventually become the leaders. I myself personally have moved away from cheaper brands to more natural products, not necessarily thinking that that was because of, you know, the planet. For me, it was about they were better quality products. And if I'm going to buy it, I would rather. And I think sometimes people need to acknowledge that the better you buy, the longer it lasts. You know, I've got stuff which I've had for a long, long time. It's still in life, but you know, it's expensive, but it's lasted a long time. Packaging is another issue. You know, I've spoke to a lot of companies. Neil's Yard have done some really good stuff around packaging. You know, I'm still not convinced that I want to be able to go in and take my own pot in and fill it. Because I mean,
it's a big ask, isn't it?
Because there's something about beauty where the aesthetics of it, the looking at it makes it a little bit special. We give beauty products as birthday presents, Christmas presents. And I think they're not luxury, they're regarded as luxury, they're very often essential, but there is something about the visuals of a beauty product which makes it, it's glamorous, isn't it? And that, for me, is part of the whole well-being of it. It's like a treat. If you have a treat, you feel nice about something, and that lifts your mood. So it is difficult for them, but there are ways that they can recycle. They can use glass and, you know, use less plastic and cardboard are obvious things. But it's, you know, it, I would be reluctant to see them give up the luxury visual. But no, the environment is really important, but well-being is important as well. So we can't sacrifice one for the other.
I mean, that's really interesting because I talk a lot to people. I'm often given seminars on the history of beauty. And, you know, I talk a lot about beauty and self-care being an ancient ritual, really. You know, it goes right back deep to within our human history of, you know, this desire to paint our bodies and to ritualize this idea of taking care of ourselves. And
Cleopatra. Actually,
yeah, exactly. You know, there's so many documentation of it. And actually, I think, you know, the lockdowns, as horrendous as they were, it gave us all that little bit more time to re-ritualize things that we took for granted. So even just washing the face and, you know, washing and looking after your hair, you know, suddenly it became a bit of me time, a bit of self-care time. I do agree with you on that, that, you know, we do consider beauty products a luxury. And perhaps there's the way that beauty companies can balance things up. I mean, you already mentioned that beauty companies tend to be very generous and actually won't want those that are less fortunate to miss out on, you know, the luxury that they can offer. So I think
and very often they're offering the basics. I did flippantly use the word. I did a debate this week on the cost of living, how people struggle, and I actually talked about beauty bags, but I talked about that they were offering, in inverted commas, luxury products like soap and shower gel and deodorant. They're not luxury products. They're essentials.
Required. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it's really important that, you know, actually as consumers, we're really aware of, you know, we require these things. It's really important. It's actually as important as, you know, turning up for work. You know, it's like you say, it's how you present yourself, how you put yourself out there to the world. It's a hugely important issue. Well, I mean, it's been brilliant to talk to you today, and thank you so much for joining
us. My pleasure.
I'm pretty sure we might be coming back to you at some point later on in the show because we've got so much to talk about with you, but thanks ever so much.
Menopause, we need to talk about the menopause because the industry is a contributor to products that make women on the menopause feel better, and that's my, I got a private members group bill going through, and I'm desperately trying to rid to the world of the taboo around talking about the menopause. And so that's something we can talk about.
I remember being back as, you know, a youth and actually talking about menstruation was a real taboo. Now that's quite well widely embraced, you know, as women, you know, it's very unlikely that you won't have a period. And, you know, so it's something that we need to be able to talk about. But like you say, menopause, such a taboo and, you know, can really affect how a woman's self-esteem is because the physical effects that it has on her body. And so, but yeah, we'd love to come back and talk to you about that at a later date. Thanks very much.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Have your say, have your say, have your say. Tweet us at Natalie Elliott Life and get involved with the show. Put your questions to the experts.
That's right, tweet us, get involved with the discussions that are happening and share your views on the topics that we are talking about. Okay, moving on, we're going to be talking to Helena Gresk, the Chief Operating Officer of the British Beauty Council. The British Beauty Council, then, to give our listeners a bit of background, it sits really in a position between beauty brands and businesses on one side and then access to key governmental bodies and regulators on the other. On your website, it's actually really helpful because you talk about these three strategic pillars of reputation, education and innovation. I'm keen to explore what this means for both beauty businesses and consumers. Could you give us a bit more insight?
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's a really good question. So our three pillars, as you've said, are kind of they form our key roadmap of our intentions of the activities that we will work on as an organisation to impact on the sector. So obviously, everything that we do that impacts on the services sector, as in the hair and beauty businesses and the brands that we work to support, has that kind of secondary impact back to the consumer. So if we look to tackle something that supports with sustainability that within the brands or within the salons and spas, that might have then an impact on the raw materials, the packaging, and that end, you know, point that's delivered back to the consumer and the consumer choice. If we tackle something, a subject within education, that obviously raises the standard of therapist that the consumer will receive when they go to visit the salon and spa. So everything that we do really straddles across to benefit the services sector and ultimately the end consumer also. Yes. So, I mean, a lot of what we do, particularly through the pandemic, has been very much the political lobbying side of things, raising the reputation of the industry and looking at understanding the value and the contribution of what the UK hair and beauty industry is to the UK economy, because previously that was something that was unexplored and not really understood. So the council commissioned a report called The Value of Beauty just before the pandemic, as if hindsight, crystal baller. And that was absolutely fantastic because it actually meant that we had those figures to be able to have those conversations with the government and try to get them to understand the size and scope and value of the sector throughout the pandemic. And if you just look to how we opened coming out of the first lockdown, we were one of the last sectors to open with most restrictions. And when we came out of the last one, we were one of the first earliest to open. We had the highest level of grant. So there's been a real journey there that we've gone on with the various government departments to really get them to understand the value and kind of the mission of the sector. So I think that's been a real positive that we've seen come out of that. That's kind of one example of how
I mean, not many of us will actually stop and think about how frustrating it must have been for beauty businesses when, you know, the hospitality and food were getting their eat out to help out and all these incentives for people to actually go and spend their money to support these businesses. And beauty was just completely discounted at that time, wasn't it? Did you find a lot of your members coming to you saying, look, you know, this isn't right, I need help here?
Yeah, I mean, lots of the businesses were truly on a cliff edge. You know, a lot of our businesses are smaller businesses, 60%+ of the sector are self-employed. And there was, you know, there was a lot of gaps in terms, there was very, you know, generous levels of government funding, but a lot of people did fall through the gaps of those initial phases and weren't able to access funding in a lot of ways. And it wasn't even just kind of looking at it purely from a sectoral business perspective. It was also that wider impact of what was happening to our communities, to the people around us, to the customers that we treat every single week or month. Or, you know, people were in situations where they were locked down, away from family and friends and loved ones, not working, not seeing their colleagues. A lot of people were in situations where they weren't interacting with anybody at all. And sometimes, in a lot of instances, you know, the therapist or the hairdresser can be the confidant, the lifeline. You know, for the older lady who lives alone, coming to have her monthly pedicure could be her only interaction other than going to the supermarket alone. And, you know, it really was distressing because there was a lot of situations where, you know, we had lots of younger therapists who were really struggling, not having that interaction and being isolated, right through to the clients and guests saying, you know, I'm really missing coming in and missing the treatments. Yeah. You know, people who have got kind of long-term health issues, who have, say, massage for certain things to help relieve kind of, you know, pain and things like that. So it was such a varied kind of time with so many different reasons that it was distressing for people, the business owners, on so many levels, because whilst they were concerned about the survival of their businesses, trying to pay the rent and the bills and keep, you know, looking after their teams, they were also concerned about the well-being of their teams, the well-being of their guests. And there was a lot more kind of to the situation than purely just thinking about the impact on the businesses themselves.
Yeah, sure. So there's that whole mental health issue as well, isn't there? That connection that we all lost. Yeah, it's funny. I imagine quite a few people, if you're not involved in the sector, might not have considered that. It's important we all sort of take heed of that and realise how important those little structures are. So did you notice then a difference between performance of beauty services like salons and makeup artists and therapists and the sort of performance of beauty brands then during the pandemic? Was there a complete opposite happening with beauty brands, do you think?
Well, it was different for the brands because they were able, in many cases, able to transition through e-commerce and trade online and adapt their businesses to operate in a different way, similar to what we saw, as you said, across, you know, much of the hospitality sector and restaurants and things. They were able to kind of maneuver themselves, pivot, if you like, into this, you know, opportunity to do takeaway or very much kind of evolve their businesses in that way. Where with what we do, from a services point of view, thinking purely about kind of the hair and beauty salons and the spas, what we do is a hands-on service. You can't deliver somebody a massage or a facial online. There was lots of fantastic things happening. People were doing online consultations and well-being checks, and you know, some of the bigger properties did some wonderful things. We saw people moving yoga and meditation classes online, and you know, people, you know, hair consultations and encouraging hairdressers, encouraging people not to box dye. I think we really did see, and I mean, it was heartwarming. I cried so many times.
The human spirit and what we're able to do, the compassion we can show each other, was demonstrated beyond what we ever imagined we could do.
It was fantastic. So beautiful to see, and everybody really working together. And I think that's what we have found as the British Beauty Council, because we are very much, because we're not a trade body or a trade association, we're an advocacy group, so we work across the sector. And it was really nice to see everybody working together, not at odds, and that was like across the board. So all the trade bodies and associations and organizations working together, all the businesses pulling together and sharing advice, and therapists, and there were so many online forums and chats and different things happening that the industry really did pull together, and I think showed the true spirit and the nature of, you know, the hugely caring, innovative kind of industry that we are, really. So yeah, it was really beautiful to see.
Yeah, fantastic. And are there any sort of key issues that the British Beauty Council are finding emerging at the moment? Any real prominent issues that you're needing to focus on now that we're out of the pandemic, hopefully, fingers crossed, and life is getting back to a so-called norm?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the COVID recovery piece is something that's still very much on the agenda. Although we are open now, and we've had some fantastic feedback, a lot of businesses have got back to fantastic, you know, business levels again. I think there's just been those changes in how we operate. Lots of businesses, even though the guidance and restrictions in terms of how we operate have now been relaxed, a lot of the businesses have made the decision to keep and implement a lot of the measures that were in place beforehand in terms of, you know, operating in a safe way, because even though that's been removed now kind of from legislation, so it's not a legal requirement anymore, businesses want to protect their guests and their teams. You know, and it's very challenging if you end up having your team, you know, teams off for self-isolation and having to close your business because of all these various things. So there's still lots of challenges there, but COVID recovery is a big point. There's, you know, there's a lot of debt. People really need to now look at that building back better and how we can look at the way that we've transitioned and evolved our businesses through the pandemic to where we are now, but how we can evolve to grow and make them even better. So there's lots of conversations around apprenticeships and education, and obviously the government have got the Help to Grow scheme and various other things at the moment. So we're really trying to encourage our members and the other organisations across the sector are as well, to really kind of tap into the government schemes that are available and just make sure you arm yourself with the knowledge of the things that are there to be able to support you, you know, moving forward and encourage, you know, encourage people to try to take those opportunities to really support them in moving forward. And then Brexit, obviously, that was like the B word.
I know. So and then it was the C word, yep.
So sorry to swear, Natalie. And then obviously Brexit, from a brand perspective, trading is still incredibly challenging. There's a long road ahead. And I think a lot of the smaller brands have found that that's really impacted on their ability to trade in Europe. And we're seeing a lot more brands kind of looking at ways to trade in other areas like North America. Obviously, China's opening up a bit now, and there's been, you know, all those conversations around animal testing and things like that. But the China piece is potentially going to be something that will be fantastic for British brands. Yeah. But at the moment, they do need to be manufactured in the UK. So there's other issues and challenges going on, but definitely kind of the trading side of things outside of Brexit is a real focus from the brand side of things. And then we've got the race to zero, environmental sustainability. You know, we are a sector that can really contribute and play our part in that. And we, as the British Beauty Council, actually commissioned the Courage to Change report in 2019. And off the back of that, have recently formed our Sustainable Beauty Coalition. So we'll be really championing what that looks like in the coming months and years, and trying to support that as well. And then obviously standards and routes into the careers industry through education and training. And we're really keen to, you know, shape and encourage what the sector looks like and make sure that young people understand that a career in beauty can be a lifelong career.
Yeah,
and it's so diverse. There are so many options, cosmetic science, beauty therapy, you know, it's so broad. And I think people, we've always kind of been looked at to be a bit superfluous, or the industry that you might go into as a career if you maybe not considered to be academic. Yeah. Actually, it's so broad. There are so many diverse opportunities. You know, you can come into this industry and travel the world and you know, do so many different things. So, yeah, there's lots we want to do. It's very exciting. But really, education is the key now for this new generation and bringing them into our industry and, you know, what that means for the future of the sector, really.
Yeah, brilliant. And finally, let's just talk about emerging trends that are arising from current consumer demand. I mean, a lot of the shows that are going to be coming up that are following this is obviously the first show we're running, but emerging from this is, you know, a lot of issues and changes. Consumers are demanding more of vegan products, organic, this whole idea of clean beauty. Are you noticing that there's a real emergence of those trends maybe feeding into the beauty businesses as well? So, for example, hair salons having to think about what products they're actually using on their customers due to the demand from them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we are led by the consumer very much so. You know, we have to evolve and make sure that we're delivering what the consumer wants. And I think just to go back to what I was saying a few moments ago about the Courage to Change report, that report highlighted that, you know, people are increasingly influenced by environmental claims and wanting to, you know, do the right thing. So I think in the report it said 90% of people wanted clearer information on how to recycle beauty products, and 91% of people wanted less packaging, 88% of people wanted to be able to refill their cosmetics. So all of those kind of statistics that came out of that report are really key for us understanding the consumer behaviour and what the consumer wants from that. So we as an industry now really do need to be taking that on board and reacting to start to make those changes. And that's where the Sustainable Beauty Coalition really comes into play, because we want to be able to start to develop initiatives and help then bring the industry along on this real journey to become more sustainable in every way that we possibly can.
Yeah, you've painted such a lovely, amazing, positive picture of an industry that I'm passionate about myself. And, you know, I know our listeners, you know, listening into the show are going to share that passion. And it's fantastic. Thank you for the amazingly optimistic outlook. And brilliant. If you have some time and you want to research more about what the British Beauty Council does, could you give us the website address so that people know where to go?
Yes, of course. Yes, it's www.britishbeautycouncil.com, and we're on all of the various social media platforms as well. So, yeah, do follow us and follow the work we're doing and see what the British beauty industry has got to bring.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So joining me now is Becky Barge, the senior news reporter from Cosmetics Business and Pure Beauty magazine. Thank you for joining us today, Becky. It's lovely to have you on the show. And I want to start by talking to you as someone who is really at the front line of what's going on in the beauty industry, the major shifts and changes. What insights into emerging trends can you tell us about? What are you noticing in the demands from consumers for beauty products at the moment?
Well, I think that Alexia Ng, she's the CEO and founder of Cult Beauty, you know, she's got it right when she coined that beauty shoppers are prosumers. You know, there's been this huge cultural shift in people knowing what's in their beauty products, and it's not enough anymore for brands to attempt to fob off their consumers with jargon that they can't really relate to. Yeah. Because I think that there's so many other beauty brands out there. There's so much competition, and somebody's very happily going to go and find another brand that they can actually resonate with. So I think just being as open and honest with them, with your consumers, is just so important. And I think that really gives indie brands a bit of an edge, because for legacy brands, it's much harder to be as nimble. Mm. You know, companies like Isle of Paradise, you know, the tanning brand, they were able to turn around a tanning spray applicator in 6 months after seeing a trend on TikTok. And that's just not in the wheelhouses of L'Oreal or Estee Lauder, but it's something that they're definitely working on, you know, picking up smaller startups. And I think that's what we're going to see a lot more of. People, brands being a lot more responsive, I guess, to what's going on in the market. I think that's a big change.
What we're seeing then is really consumers driving the market. And
absolutely, 100%. And in terms of actual trends, I think that what we're seeing is so much more multi-use products. Mm. You know, people are, they don't want to buy, spend 30, 40 pounds on a product that just does one thing. But then on the flip side of that, there's a bit of a catch 22 when you think about self-care, because during lockdown, everyone was so willing to spend more time on their skincare.
The ritualization.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they had 7 to 8 products, you know, as part of their daily routine. But as we shift back into something that kind of resembles our previous life, customers want to be able to use products for multiple applications, you know, an oil or a serum that doubles up to go in their foundation, or, you know, a moisturizer that's got an SPF in it. But yeah, there's another sort of movement I've seen. Well, at Cosmetics Business, we very recently did a survey on the rise of clean and how that sort of changed. And I know that's a big topic for you. You've talked about that so much. Yeah. And I see clean in a way as looking at sustainability and being considerate to the planet. But what we saw from this survey was that people wanted, obviously, skincare, clean was a big thing that they wanted. But then in fragrance as well is something that people are wanting to see more of. And I find that really interesting as well, because a lot of people resonate with clean as being vegan. But if you look at an at-home, you know, fragrance, a candle, that's beeswax. So, you know, just how that's going to catch on, I'm not quite sure. But I think that that's something that I'm curious to know more about and see how that's going to work in the market.
Our listeners well know I'm really quite an avid campaigner for, you know, beauty brands that are really thinking about and considering the ingredients that they're using. I mean, you've talked a little bit there about the larger beauty houses. And actually, you know, a lot of those are rooted deep within the beauty history and are perhaps using ingredients that have just become a little bit dated now. Actually, it's brilliant that you've brought that up, because I wanted to talk to you about the fact that in 4 weeks' time, the UK is hosting the climate change conference. Mm-hmm. And I've been noticing on social media a lot of the other major industries within the UK, such as sport, travel, food, coming forward and saying, well, this is what we propose we can do. Here's the changes we can make to how we manufacture and how we deliver our goods to consumers. What do you think the beauty industry can do? You know, what can we do? I mean, there's so much to change, isn't there? So what do you think are the main focuses?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I spoke to someone very recently, sort of on this topic. I recently did a piece on this, and I wanted to look at how the climate crisis is going to affect beauty in the long term, and what that's going to look like for natural ingredients, you know, and supply chains. But what I think is so important is I think that previously beauty brands would maybe going to their suppliers, they would sort of have like a little bit of a jostle with who can get this the best, maybe the cheapest or the fastest. But I think that sustainability is really, it's going to start with people investing in their supply chains. Yeah. If you can invest in getting palm oil from that's responsibly sourced, or putting into an initiative that's helping, you know, people growing vanilla in Madagascar, looking at that makes such a difference. And I don't think it's enough for people to just say, we're just going to get the cheapest or whatever is available to us, because it's just not good enough anymore. I think investing in your supply chains is just really, really important.
One of the things I want to talk to you about is the Insta trend. And is that having a positive or a negative effect on consumers? What do you think about that? First of all, what do you think the Insta effect is? And what do you think it's going to do to the mindset of buyers?
Yeah, I think the Insta effect, it's from a brand's perspective, I think your positioning on social media really depends on your audience. You know, if you're looking to attract Gen Z's, millennials, social media is the place to be. There's no denying it. It's, you know, look at Huda Beauty, for example. She is the undisputed queen of social media, and her brand is constantly, you know, hitting, you know, just top hitting in terms of visibility and post values, and that's amazing. And it's not just Instagram either. You know, look at TikTok, you know, what that's done for the beauty community. I mean, albeit there are some pretty crazy fads being posted on there, which is, you know, a bit insane. But, you know, L'Oreal is getting its brands involved in TikTok, launching social media, you know, selling platforms and using it as a platform for customers to buy their products. Mm-hmm. You know, what I think social media, what it can do is unfathomable. Yeah. But the pitfalls can be, I think it's authenticity. I think that just comes down to it so much that, and if you're partnering with influencers, it's just so key. If brands are being misleading on these platforms, for me personally, as a customer, I would be really put off by that. Mm-hmm. And I think I see an awful lot of people on Instagram, you know, the ASA are getting so involved in this, and people using filters and not showing the product properly. It's giving rise to this different outlook of beauty that I don't think is particularly healthy. And I think it's really important that that authority and watchdog is there in order to be able, you know, to clamp down on that stuff, because it's just not good for the consumer, and it doesn't set a good precedent for the beauty industry and who we are.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. I mean, I've actually a mum to a very young daughter. She's only 9 years old. And, you know, she's falling into that category of youngsters that are really massively being influenced. And I'm actually quite horrified that, you know, she had a school photo a few weeks back and she was upset because she couldn't achieve the look she wanted. And when I sat down and talked to her about it, it was actually came down to, you know, the way these women and young girls are presenting themselves on Instagram with filters and with so much makeup, you know, that's just not realistic. And that's a real worry to me. And I just wonder, what can the beauty industry do to help to curb that? I suppose, does it just come down to choices, who you choose to be your influencer, the whole ethos that you place behind it?
Yeah, such an interesting question, because, I mean, I wouldn't want to be a teenager or a young girl growing up in this Instagram world. I think it would terrify me. And it's something that it does put these insane pressures on young girls and young women to look a certain way. But what I think is so, I mean, Huda Katan as well from Huda Beauty, she's done an amazing job. I think she's quite open about the plastic surgery or things that she's kind of put into her face. But she also talks very openly about how toxic that this space is, filtering, editing. And I think what needs to happen is brands need to come forward and say that we don't deem this to be acceptable. Yeah. They're the ones that need to set a precedent here. And I think as soon as one starts doing it, it's, you know, it always happens. There's just a snowball effect. And I think more needs to be done from them. You know, consumers, you know, that's obviously a point for where people go and discover products and look at things like that. And I think making sure that people are putting the correct information out there also makes just a really big difference. I think that's something that, yeah, also needs to be looked at, checked into, and just make sure that you're double checking. Yeah. All of your facts and make sure you're getting the right information.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate that. And we'll probably speak to you at some point soon in the future. Well, that's it for today's show. Join me again next week when we'll start to deep dive into some of the topics explored today. Starting with sustainable beauty, I'll be talking to Dr. Emma Meredith of the CTPA and Mark Vida, co-founder of sensational beauty brand Skip, proving that sustainable beauty really is a possibility.